Gambit Rail 2.
I want to go back to my school days. I've forgotten to tell you this. I was very lucky. My guardian used to send me off to all these various places. She always looked after my education further abroad too, because first of all, she took my sister, the one that's just a bit younger than me, and I on a cruise to Greece, on a Greek cruise. We went round the Greek islands, and it was absolutely fantastic. We stayed in Venice. No, we didn't. We stayed on board the cruise ship. But we went to Venice, of course. And always remember Santa Maria della Salute. And to begin with, they wouldn't let me in because I had short sleeve dress. And so somebody lent me a cardigan, so I was allowed to go in, and it was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. This beautiful place. But I wasn't allowed to go into the Doge's Palace because I can't remember why, but I'd been a naughty girl. So my punishment was not to go in the Doge's Palace. St. Mark's Square was lovely. We had our photograph taken there. And that was one holiday. And then several times she sent me off to Switzerland because she had some friends out there and we used to stay there for school holidays. And that was lovely. But I was about 15, 16, 17. I don't know. I left school when I was 18, as I told you. And I used to go on my own. No aeroplanes then. I used to go on the, what did they call it? The Golden Arrow from Victoria Station, across the channel, and I was seasick like mad. I used to hate it. Didn't go Dover Calais, went the long way, New Haven Dieppe, because it was so cheaper, I suppose, down to Paris. And then I had to go from the Gare du Nord to Gare de Lyon in a taxi, and then down to, I think the border's called, is it Domodossola? On to Switzerland, and at that young age, I was still young and independent, still going on my own.
So wonderful education. Yeah, wonderful experience and education for a growing child, growing person.
Mm-hmm. Makes you independent. So,
you became ill, you were saying, in the hospital.
I didn't become ill, it was just my health. I just wasn't strong enough to keep doing the nursing bit.
It's very heavy, demanding work, isn't it? Physically demanding work.
Yes.
So what did you do then when you left the hospital?
Then my guardian, she's the sort of person, when she travels around, she talks to people. It doesn't matter who it is, if you find somebody interesting, doesn't matter what age. She must have been in France for something or other, because she was coming back from France, and she sat sitting next to this young man with a train, said he'd just come back to see his aunts, who were in a hospital down the south of France at a place called L'Hospitalier de Gibault. It was a little hospital for TB children, TB limbs, not lungs, TB limbs. There was a big hospital in Nice, and they used to accommodate 12 children at a time, small children there. And so she sent me down there. So there I was for years in this hospital with these 12 children, and I was in charge of one little girl called Marie. She was only about three, she had rickets, so I was in charge of her. The children had TB limbs, and they were in bed for 5 years, and those little kids, they knew exactly the time when the 5 years was up, because there were two of them, a boy and a girl. 5 years was up while I was there, and then they were allowed out of bed for 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. It was wonderful. I got all the photos. It really was. It was a lovely.
How did you find the French people that you did come into contact with?
Lovely, because I could speak French anyway. You see, so I mean, there was no problem there. And anyway, most of them speak English. And my days off, I used to go into, I can't remember if it was Nice or Cannes. I used to go to either or. Because there was always a flower festival in the news. But there was an English cinema called George V Cinema. And I think there's still a hotel there called George V Cinema to go to the cinema. That was lovely. Went to the Glass, to the perfume factories.
No anti-English feeling that manifested itself?
Well, this was before the war. Yeah.
So this was about, what, 1936, 37, that kind of time?
Yes, so I left school, yes, so 1836, yes. I had to go back and take another exam, which I didn't like, but never mind. So I was in Tunbridge Wells, actually, when Edward VIII abducted.
And you left France for Tunbridge Wells, did you? You said you were there about a year in France.
No, not Tunbridge Wells, I was nursing first, when I left Brighton. And then I went to south of France.
And you were there a year, as you said, around about, was it?
Yes, about a year. And then I came back home, and I went to Malmesbury in Wiltshire. I told you, when I was little, we used to go to this school where I didn't mention the fact it was run by these three sisters. And they moved from Cheadle in Staffordshire, and they went to Malmesbury in Wiltshire. So all that long time, so 10 years or more, I got back with them again, and they still had a school in Malmesbury in this Woodhead, what was it called? So I was there for quite a while as a under nanny. Nanny looked after the children, and I looked after the older ones, 12 of them. No washing machines, and all the washing in the army. But it was nice.
You enjoyed that.
I was friends again. See, my sister was there too. And of course, I knew them very well. So I was working for them instead of them educating me. And then suddenly, the war was on.
Well, you were getting paid for these for this work.
Yes.
Not a lot of money, presumably.
Not to exist. I mean, it didn't matter because I mean, we weren't paying board and lodging or anything like that. And the school was run by what they called gentlefolk. There weren't any maids to scrub or anybody to make the beds, do the fires. We did it. Everybody did it, even the teachers. Because in the term time, it was still a school. And of course, they had the dancing classes. And I remember the teacher that used to come down from London. Her name was Madame Vacani. And she used to come down once a week to teach the children dancing. And at one time, when they were very, very small, we had Duke of Kent and his sister, Princess Marina, they came down for dancing as well. But the war had already started then, I think, or maybe it was just before the war, I can't remember, because I knew that all the war stories were on.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about we're reaching that period in time now. How were you aware or made aware that there were problems, war problems were coming?
Well, listening to the radio. And we were all very much into it because the two sisters, their name was Hunt, the two Miss Hunts, they didn't marry. We had a huge map on the wall and there were flags and things on. And we sort of put flags in where our troops were and where they were and all this kind of thing, you know, what was happening, etc. So we were very much involved with the war only through the wireless and through their enthusiasm. We weren't doing any war work or anything like that, but that didn't come into it then, not at the beginning.
Were precautions taken against bombing raids?
No.
Before you weren't sandbagged up? Or?
No, we were too far in the country, we thought this can't happen. What
about
it was a lovely place.
Gas masks, had they been issued to you?
Not at the time, no. But even, so that was, what can I think? So it must have been the summer of 39. We took the children to Borth again, where we used to go when I was little. And then war was declared in
September.
Mm-hmm. So we're still there in September. And so the two Hunts, the two the headmistresses, had to take some of the children back to Malmesbury. And I was in charge of all the other children, still listening to the radio. And I remember sometime or other, it was saying, talking about, I didn't realise the children were being evacuated. All I knew was that the children were being out in the streets and things, and they all had labels on them so they wouldn't get lost. Now this actually, in retrospect, referred to the children who were being evacuated, but that didn't sink into me at the time. So I put luggage labels on all my children's underwear. Underneath their dresses and trousers, they all had little labels on them so they wouldn't get lost.
Do you recall where you were, what you were doing when the actual announcement of war, when Chamberlain made the announcement?
Yes, I was in Malmesbury at the time. No, I wasn't. I was in Bath. Of course I was. Mm-hmm. That's why they had to take the children home, because they were listening to the wireless thing, and that's when he came with his big paper.
Did it strike you, the seriousness of the situation?
I can't honestly remember. Did it? I know the whole country was very patriotic and very royalist as well. I knew that we were involved, but whether it was, I mean, I was only born right at the end of the First World War, but I was very aware of what was going on, because when I was at Hamilton House, we used to have a rest after lunch, and we all had to lie on the floor, go to the library and get a book, and lie on the floor and look at the book, and I always used to get out these war books. So I knew there was a war on. Now, whether it was that it excited me, or whether I felt I was involved, or whether it was part of my life, I really couldn't tell you. But it was just something that was a continuation of what, education or what, I can't really remember what it was about. But no, I wasn't, oh my goodness, there's war on, nothing like that. So of course we used to listen to the news, and also we listened to the bombardment of the recruiting campaign. And that's where I start my talk, actually. I start at the beginning. I tell them where I was in Malmesbury. I say, we listen to the war news and the bombardment of the recruiting campaign. Your country needs you, etc. Being very patriotic and 21 years old, I got carried away. The next question was, which branch of the forces should I join? I didn't think the brown army uniform would suit me. I briefly thought of the Navy and promptly felt seasick. The Air Force uniform I thought was more flattering, so I decided to join the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. That's as simple as that.
And at this time, what date would this be?
It was, I joined up in April, 19th of April.
1940.
Well, I enrolled 19th of April, 1940.
And by then, the impact of war hadn't been so great, because you had the phony war.
Yes, but people were over in France and doing all the necessary bits there. But it was just that the recruiting campaign was really very quite forceful. And of course, you can still remember the bit of Kitchener saying, your country needs you, because the posters were up and everything like that. And it was an ongoing campaign to get people to come and join. And I decided I would join. So I did.
And there were no problems with people trying to persuade you to stay where you were?
No. I had nobody to ask. In fact, I didn't even tell them when I went and joined. I went up to London. I came back and I said, I've just joined the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. Do you mind? As simple as that.
What was the process of joining?
See if I can remember. I went to... I think I'm right in remembering this. I had to go to the RAF headquarters, which at the time was in Holborn, Kingsway, Adastral House, I think. I can't honestly remember where I went for that, but I do know that there were quite a few of us, and we were trained off to West Drayton.
You would go to the recruiting officer,
yes,
what it was, and
it was in London, but I can't honestly remember where it was. No.
And in effect, you signed on. You signed on for them.
Yes.
And were you given the usual oath when you signed on? You can't recall that.
No, I don't recall
as some people did.
Because no. we weren't regular. We weren't regular. Oh. We were
So they then sent you to, where did you say you went to?
West Drayton.
And how were you received there? Try to imagine that first entry into this place.
I'll tell you. Really?
There's a big difference between your life up to now and what it was about to be.
Yeah. Just a second. Tell you. Yeah, here. I went to Adastral House, and it was a very gloomy place. was sent upstairs, and there was a lady up there, and she said, hang on a bit, so which I did, twiddled my thumbs. So I filled in the irrelevant forms, obviously the name, address, and all that kind of thing, date of birth, etc. My ego returned, and when the elderly lady shook me vigorously by the hand and said, well done, my dear, and sped me on my way, you'll be hearing from us. So I went back down to Malmesbury, and I did get a letter a few days later. And we went up to London again. Well, we didn't go up to London, we had to go to the recruiting section at West Drayton. And I remember it was all Nissen huts, the corrugated Nissen huts. And we all went into there, into a hut, as civilians. And we came out as Air Force guys. It was marvellous. We had to go to the stores, of course, and get all our
things. Yeah, I was going to ask you if we could take this stage by stage. You've arrived there. Let's talk first of all about the accommodation that you had there in these nuts. What were they like, the actual accommodation itself?
I can't remember how many beds. I have a vague idea there were 32 beds, but I think I'm not exaggerating. There could have been 16 or whatever. And it was just as you see in any army camp. Excuse me. They were missing huts built for men. And so the beds were all like a hospital, almost, you know, you can see them on the films. And it was all clean and highly polished, because this is the way it is in the Air Force, the Army, anything you like. With all the bedding, there was ablutions built for men. So of course we had to do all, the only private place was the bathroom. So all the rest was. But on a day-to-day basis, when you got up in the morning, everybody had to clean the hut on your knees, polish the floor.
And what time would the reveille be?
I can't remember, but it was probably going around 6:30, 7 o'clock, like that. We didn't go there the first day. I just got down here that when we arrived, it's just like you see on the films, a motley crew of completely bewildered girls carrying suitcases all shuffling around like disorientated ducks, and that's just what shuffled into these huts. And then the next day, of course, we went to get our uniforms. Well, we didn't all get our uniforms straight away because of the sizes, etc. So I spent the first few days in my navy blue skirt. But we did get done eventually. And of course, being in a school where you had shirt and ties, I knew how to tie a tie, but a lot of them didn't. So we had to go through all that.
What uniform did they issue you with?
Right, basics, bra, suspender belt, stockings, pants, knickers, mm-hmm. elastic top and bottom, and eventually, as time went on, they used to call them passion killers. no petticoats, shirt, tie, skirt, jacket, and cap. But not the caps you see these days. They're the round, the peak. In the front there. Got a photo of me somewhere.
And you say that you were essentially measured for them, if they didn't have the size in, you had to wait. Was that the...
Well, it was a bit like, you really do see them on the... What size are you? Right, here you are. What size is that? Right, here you are. Kind of thing, you know. And you tried them on, and if they didn't fit, then you took them back and had to get the right ones. But we must have had more than one, sort of, usually, I think three was the usual thing.
Where was your uniform kept in the billet?
In a locker. We had our own locker, and it all had to be done every day. You had to polish your shoes, polish your buttons, and brush your skirts, and clean shirt and tie and everything. Everything had to be absolutely right, which is good, because you didn't get a sloppy force there. You'd get everybody, and of course we had our gas masks and tin hats. The tin hats fitted into the back of the gas masks.
Can we come back to the accommodation? You said that on a morning you rose, and your first task presumably was to make your beds. Was that again in the
stat? You didn't make a bed until you had happened. You get it up in the morning, the bedclothes were stacked. The mattress was in three parts called biscuits. These were piled on top of each other at the top of the bed. Then the blankets were folded in a special way. Then the sheets, and on top of that, the pillows, all in perfect alignment, and so it was every day. So you did that, you had your wash, ablution and all the rest of it, stacked your bed, and I think I remember that shoes and brasses were polished the night before. Because not only were you issued with your clothing, you were issued with shoes, of course, a button stick, shoe polish, two brushes for your shoes, and one brush for clothing. I think we had our own toothbrush and toothpaste, towels. And all this, you see, the towels and the bedding and everything belonged to them, so you changed them and they went to the laundry and then you got clean ones every week. I think that was all that we were. In fact, I'll tell you something, the brushes that I had then I still got, they're in my shoebox.
So you make your beds,
yes.
What was the next thing?
Before you got yourself dressed up for a parade, then you had to clean, polish the floor, clean the windows.
Now how was this? How was this done?
Everybody did their own part.
Your own space.
Their own space. And then there were usually, sometimes there were two orderlies. It depends if the windows had to be cleaned. Otherwise, there was just one orderly that was left behind. Cleaned your own space. Well, you did bed, got yourself dressed, cleaned your space, polished your floor. Locker, top of locker, everywhere, bed, dusted all that, everything had to be done absolutely correctly. And of course, it was quite easy to do then because the airmen had been doing it before when they lived there. So we went into the same Nissen hut. And then when that was all done, put your uniform on.
The actual polishing of the floor, what did you use?
Mansion polish.
And how did you clean them? Was it hands and knees? It wasn't the bumper.
No, hands and knees with a polishing cloth. I think there must have been a bumper for the centre. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so, because there wasn't much room in the centre anyway. I think it just went so for everybody did their own. In fact, used to go a little bit the other
way. You didn't have a table in the centre at all?
No, but there was a fire. There was a square base, and on the square base was this circular fire.
Potbelly stove,
pot
kind of thing.
Potbelly stove, yes. Which soon you end up. And of course, that had to be, the orderly had to do that. And you had different orderly every day. So the orderly had to do that, clean out the bottom, put new coal in, polish the pet bonnet, polish the stove. What did you call it? Pot belly stove. Polish the pot belly stove. Say that in the head. Polish that with a SIBO, with blacking stuff.
And the coal scuttle there?
The coal scuttle. Yeah. Everything had to be done. Cleaned. All the ashes had to be cleaned out and put away. In the bin outside, there'd be a bin outside with all the rubbish, anybody's rubbish, all that had to be done.
The ablution toilets, they would have to be cleaned, presumably?
Yes, well, the orderly would do that.
But that was the orderly's task.
I think there must have been two orderlies. And of course, anybody who was on their jacket, who would get to survival, would have to do that as well. It was part of the punishment. I had that once too, I'll tell you about that another time.
How did you find the girls that you were with in the hut? They must have been a very wide background.
Very wide, yes, very wide. All sorts and every sort. But being me, I was able to get on like that. I never sort of made excuses for people that, oh, well, you haven't got any money, I have. Because I never had money. The first time I ever had money of my own was when I went into the hospital and I earned my own money. It was the first time. And since then, even up to when I got married, I only ever lived on what money I earned, always.
So that wasn't a problem with you? It must have been a problem with some of the girls.
Well, it probably was a good problem, because maybe some of them hadn't ever had enough money to live on. I mean, what money we got was pocket money. We didn't have to pay for anything, not our meals, nothing.
How did you get on with each other?
Very well. Very well. Though obviously some of the girls were a bit fractious with each other. I mean, this was human nature. But I'm one of these people, I can not ignore it, but pass over the top of it. If people wanted to quarrel, okay, quarrel. But it wasn't my way of doing things. So I enjoyed it. I really did. Enjoyed every minute of it.
And you found it quite easy to mix with girls from a very wide background?
Yes,
Were the girls like that? Was their education of a better standard, because that's what was demanded of the WAFs at all, you know?
The job we were doing didn't demand education particularly, because we eventually went to, we'll come to it in the, shortly. The job that we went into didn't demand education, didn't demand it physical.
So these were a wide background of education in amongst the girls.
It's always a good point, because I mean, if somebody did something wrong, somebody says that way, oh no, it isn't, it's this way, oh yes, it is that way. I won't say it was good fun and laughing all the time, it wasn't, but nearly all of us, I can't honestly remember ever having disliked anybody. Maybe I didn't get on with them. There's always people that you don't get on with, there's always people you can't talk to. There are people who you feel, you know, are against you. I ignore them. I'm a lucky person.
So the life within the billet itself, in that initial stage, was good as far as you're concerned.
It was interesting too, I should imagine at the time. I didn't think about it then. All I thought about was that I'm in the life and here we are.
Do you recall any of the girls that started with you at that time?
Some of them later on, yes, but not then. I don't remember any of them.
And in, you know, amongst men, you have, again, the wide variety, but you get people who are physically bullies. I don't know about girls. Is it the more catty ones or what have you?
You know, a lot of ribbing from men. Oh, yes. All the time. And that, to me, was very strange, because in my school days, I'd never mixed with men. I was very shy of men. I could hardly talk to them. And there came a time in my life when I really said to myself, come on, you're not going to get anywhere. Talk. And I've never stopped since.
We'll come back to this yeah. Subject
but
with
I
the men.
We've got a lot of ribbing from the men, of course. The things they used to say, I think there were quite a lot of them didn't like women in the Air Force. It was a man's force. It wasn't a women's force at all. And they didn't know what we were going to do, if we were going to take them, the same as today. But we just took it in good part. Sometimes I didn't, because I was very shy. I thought it was pointed at me personally, to just to get used to it.